For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Lord, thanks for this time to just turn to you to say that we are in awe of the thought that you would take notice of us, that you would pursue us, that you would reveal yourself to us through your word and through your son. And we pray that here tonight, as we finish up this discussion of the claims and case for Christ, that you give us a real kind of clarity about the underpinnings of our faith, the things that are really calling us to a real world commitment to knowing you and to growing in you, and just that you would use this to give us that deep sense of confidence in your word and of belief in you. So thanks for this time. Amen. All right, like we were saying there, we've been studying the Gospel of John and came to that place in John chapter 5 where the narrative really moves a little bit out of these very intimate conversations Jesus is having with individuals, and is then kind of drawn the lens out a little bit and panning into his involvement much more broadly in society and the questions that are being raised about who he is and what he is about. And so it's in that context that Jesus begins to speak with great clarity about who he is and why people should believe in him and follow him. So I thought it would be good for us just to kind of work through that in a slow way, because I thought it was really important material. And so we've been talking about that these last few weeks in terms of Jesus' specific claims that he is God in human form. That's something that is a significant theme, in fact, in the Gospel of John, is the deity of Christ. And starting in chapter 5, Jesus himself makes it unambiguously clear who he is, that he is, in fact, God in human form, a unique claim. This is not something that the progenitors of any world religion has claimed for themselves. They may claim to have special access to God, or they may have a formula for getting to God, but no one is claiming that they are God. This is unique in the pages of the New Testament, in the words of Christ, that's who he is, and for this reason has this unique authority to speak with finality about the things of God. So we spent a week analyzing that and thinking that through. And what are the alternatives to these claims that he has made? Is he a liar or a conspirator trying to just woo people into following him down the primrose path? Maybe he's completely insane. A lot of people who would make great claims for themselves, we call megalomaniacs. We say that person's imbalanced. They've got a problem. But yet, at the same time, in studying the Gospels, we realize, you know, it's not just Jesus who's saying these things about him, but also other people. John the Baptist, who is recognized as a prophet. Other people who are looking on from the Jewish religious establishment are making similar observations about Christ, that his claims to deity are not resting merely upon his own voice, but also upon the testimony of others, including the Old Testament scriptures. And so it's plausible, at least, given the alternatives, that what Jesus is saying actually is true, or at least worth further investigation. And so we spent a couple of weeks on that further investigation along the lines of Jesus' claim also to be the Messiah, the fulfillment of Old Testament messianic hope, and as demonstrated by the Old Testament's predictions concerning him and of his resurrection from the dead. And so we spent a week saying, okay, here is Jesus is making these claims and uniquely also setting forth real criteria by which seekers like you and me can really analyze the evidence and say, is it so? Is the evidence really there that he is who he proclaims himself to be? And so we, starting with the New Testament books of 1 Corinthians and the book of Acts, books that are not disputed by any scholars in terms of their authenticity or their early date, going back as early as 55 AD in the case of 1 Corinthians, we examined the first-hand testimony of Paul, of Peter, of James, of other disciples, including, he said, as many as 500 in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 who had personally witnessed the resurrected Christ. And so we took that testimony and we measured against the data that we needed to understand and make explanation for, namely the empty tomb of Christ, which was a historic fact, the crucifixion of Christ, which is an historic fact, as is evidenced both by Jewish and Roman sources independent of the New Testament. We talked about the earliest proclamation of the Christian movement in the city of Jerusalem, the very place that these things occurred. Within weeks, literally, of the events, the sermons of Peter and John in chapters 2 and 4 of the book of Acts. And then we talked also about the rapid expansion of the church that in the apostolic era, that is the first generation of the church, reached as many as 1 million people throughout the empire. Those things need to be explained. The explanation that the New Testament gives is that Jesus absolutely rose from the dead just as he said he would. And that in the power of the witnesses to that event and the affirmation by the Spirit of God who is poured out on those who came together in this common belief, that this movement spread by persuasion and not by power in a context where there was enormous opposition both from the Jewish side and from the Roman government, so much so that by 64 AD, just 30 years after the ministry of Christ, the Emperor Nero could place blame upon the Christians for the burning of the city of Rome and then begin a empire specific persecution of the church in which thousands were rounded up and killed, burned alive, many of them, in the city of Rome. We believe that just the canons of historical research, of inductive logic, the tools that historians use to ascertain the accuracy of documents and the plausibility of witnesses absolutely fits the case of the resurrection of Christ. Then last week we moved into this other issue here, which are that Jesus believed, Jesus argued, Jesus proclaimed that you could take not just his word for the truth of who he is, but also and specifically the teaching of him in the Old Testament prediction. And we talked about that and says in John chapter 5, verse 39, this is Jesus' words. He says, "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, but it is these that testify about me." And so Jesus says, without any equivocation, I am the unique fulfillment of the messianic hope of the Old Testament. And so we followed that line out. And we said, okay, let's think about the Old Testament scriptures together. And here's a copy of the Old Testament dated to before the time of Christ. This is a part of the Dead Sea Scrolls, datable to about 200 BC. In it is a complete copy of the Old Testament. We don't have to ask ourselves, is the Old Testament that we have today somehow corrupted or forged by Christian interpreters or something like that have kind of read Jesus back into the pages of the Old Testament? That argument no longer exists because we have these copies of the Old Testament that predate Christ to up to 200 years. And so for that reason, we have a publicly accessible document from the before the time of Christ to critically examine what is it really saying about the promise of God's Messiah coming into the world. And I think this is very important for us because this is public data. This is something that anyone can sit down and read and study and find themselves convinced without some sort of an experience or whatever it is, something that we may find ourselves questioning later. But God has given us the foundation of faith that is rooted in what he has revealed and predicted hundreds of years before they come to pass. That's something that we can take a look at. We can evaluate that together. The specific, detailed predictions about God's Messiah that are in the Old Testament and which also explain and express the very heart of God and his plan for humanity. It's a remarkable opportunity. And so what we did last time was we interacted with several of these questions. We asked, who is the Messiah? And we saw very specific. There are no mystical interpretations about that, no dispute whatsoever between interpreters on any of these points. That one, the Messiah, who is the Messiah? He is from the kingly line of David. that he is unique in the sense that he's more than a man. He is also a person whom David himself could call his Lord, who Isaiah could call Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, who Micah in chapter 5 of his prophecy could call one whose goings forth are from the days of eternity. So here is a unique man, one who is more than a man, one who is, in Jesus' own words, as the Son of David, who is also the Son of God. And here Jesus so uniquely qualifies to be this Davidic Messiah. The question of what and how relate to the work of the Messiah. And so we examine those prophecies in the Old Testament that describe God's Messiah coming as reigning king, but also as a priest that intercedes on behalf of people who are alienated from God. And we saw, how does the Messiah fulfill that? Specifically in Isaiah chapter 52, starting in verse 13, and then working our way through Isaiah chapter 53. We see that this very clear picture of the one who is called my servant, who is the Messiah, who is recognized as a messianic text by the ancient Jews as they translated their Bible into Aramaic, the language of the people, from the Hebrew language. And they realize that this is talking about Messiah, and Messiah in contrast to the nation of Israel, who is offering sacrifice to atone for the guilt of the nations, not just Israel, but of the nations. And then in this incredible surprise, who has believed our message? As Isaiah 53 verse 1 states, that the one who is offering up the sacrifice to atone for human guilt is actually offering up his very life himself as that sacrifice. And that is how the Messiah accomplishes his work. And we saw just with such amazing clarity that that's exactly a description of the ministry of Jesus Christ, who came to give his life as a ransom for the many, as he says in Mark 7. Now, tonight we want to talk in even more specific terms. And we want to talk tonight about a couple of unanswered questions. Where does Messiah come from, and when specifically should we expect him? What time? And these are two very specific, and in this case of the second, the when question, some of the most remarkable material you will ever have the opportunity to examine with your own two eyes. This is incredible stuff, I believe. Let's take a look first at the predictions concerning where the Messiah comes from. It just says with such clarity in Micah 5, verse 2, "As for you, Bethlehem Ephratah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be a ruler in Israel." His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. Okay, that's just real clearly stated. Ephrathah is the family name of David, and so you can see the consistency here that God's Messiah not only comes from David's family, but also indeed from David's very household and from David's city, namely the city of Bethlehem, or the town of Bethlehem, really. So we see that fulfilled in Jesus in Matthew chapter 2, where Jesus, it says, was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. So that places him in space and time, in time during the reign of Herod, in space in this place, Bethlehem. Gathering together all the chief priests and scribes, Herod asked where the Messiah was to be born, and they answered, well, in Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet. What prophet? Well, how about the prophet we just read? That's clearly what he has in mind, because then they go on and they cite Micah chapter 5, verse 2. This was known to be a messianic text, a messianic prediction. It told everyone who's interested, here's where the Messiah is going to come from. Okay, so that's the simple question, the where question, easily answered. What we're really going to devote heavy attention to tonight is this question, the when question. When does the Old Testament predict the coming of Messiah? And so we're going to walk through a text that I think is just extraordinary. Many of us are familiar with the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. We're just going to walk through this in a very systematic way, and we're going to try to work this thing out together. So I'm just going to ask you to put your thinking cap on to work with this. We're not going to It's very straightforward on the one hand. On the other hand, it's going to require that we really think together about what's being said. The payoff is awesome. Let's take a look at the passage. It says in Daniel 9, verse 24, this is in the Old Testament. Daniel is writing in the period of the Babylonian exile. This is in the 500s BC. 500s BC. And he's receiving a vision now, and he's receiving prophetic words from God. And it says a period of 77s. And in the Hebrew, a seven is Shabuim or Shabbat. Sabbath is the word that we look at that as translated usually. A period of 77s or Sabbaths has been decreed for your people, your holy city, to finish the rebellion, to put an end to sin, to atone for guilt, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to confirm the prophetic vision, and to anoint the most holy place. Okay, so this verse here tells us what is this prophecy about. It's about the completion of human rebellion against God. It's to put an end to sin and to atone for it, to pay the price for human's guilt before a holy God, to confirm the prophetic vision. That means that to fulfill the Old Testament prophecy about Messiah. And then he says to anoint the most holy place, which is really just a reference to this idea that the Holy of Holies, this place in the temple where God is present, is anointed in the sense that man is safe in the presence of God. So it spans the whole scope then of what God is seeking to accomplish in human history. And then a time frame is given. A period of 77s, he says, has been decreed for your people. And as I said, a seven is a Sabbath. And so to interpret what's being said here, this is not some kind of smoke and mirrors, weird, whatever you want it to mean, it means kind of thing. It's not like picking up the horoscope in the weekly newspaper and, you know, something like that that's just subject to anyone's interpretation. The principles to interpret this message are embedded right within the text of the Old Testament itself. Let's talk about this. A period of 77s. What is he talking about? Like I said, a seven is a Sabbath. And so the question for the interpreter is, what is he talking about? Is he talking about a period of 70 Sabbath days? Or is he talking, as the Old Testament also does, of a period of 70 Sabbath years? That's our interpretive question, because what he is basically going to say is that we're talking about a unit of 490 either days or years. So that's the time frame that he's talking about for the consummation of all of these things. A period of 490 somethings, days or years. Well, let's talk about the context then to answer this question. Is it 490 days? Is it 490 years? Here's the background. The context of this message from God that Daniel receives in Daniel chapter 9, centers on this whole issue of the land having a Sabbath rest. Back in the law of Moses, now we're going to 1500 BC, 1400 BC. Moses, you know, gets the law from God, and it includes not just like the Ten Commandments and stuff like that, but also hundreds of other laws regulating various aspects of Israel's life, including Israel's agricultural life, which is at the center of their economy. And it says this in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 2 to 4, when you come into the land that I will give you, the land must have a Sabbath for the Lord, a rest, a Sabbath. For 6 years you shall sow your field and gather its crop. But during the seventh year, the land must have a Sabbath. And so this is what's referred to as the Sabbath year legislation. Every seventh year, the land is to lie fallow. And that was probably done so that the soil doesn't get burned out. But that, you know, just because it lays fallow for a while, it gets other things in there. And it's a better way to do things rather than just constant agriculture work that burns soil out. And also it was an opportunity to trust that God would provide for their need uniquely during this seventh year. So that is the idea of a Sabbath year. And beyond that is also the warning against disobeying this law that's very specific. And so it says in Leviticus 26, If you do not obey me, the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of your desolation while you are in your enemy's land. In other words, I am going to enforce this law whether you do or not. And he says, it will observe the rest it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living on it. So basically he's saying, I'm going to deport you. I'm going to take you out of the land if you don't observe the Sabbath year legislation so that the land will have its rest. And so that in that context then, as the city of Jerusalem and the southern tribe of Judah were being sieged by the Babylonians, the prophet Jeremiah says this. He says, this whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and you will serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. 70 years. Why? Well, we're given the reason for that. It says in 2 Chronicles 36, this is towards the end of the Old Testament. This is probably the scribe Ezra writing this history. And he says, those who escaped the sword were carried away to Babylon and lived as servants until the Persian rule, first under Cyrus the king. And this fulfilled, he says, the word of the Lord through Jeremiah, the passage that we just read, that the land will have its Sabbaths for 70 years. So it's very specific, isn't it? The land, you did not obey this Sabbath year legislation, and so you were taken away from the land for 70 years. And so Daniel then, in the chapter that we're working out of here, says this, in the first year of Darius's reign, Darius is a Medo-Persian emperor, I, Daniel, observed in the books, namely the book of Jeremiah, the number of years which was revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah, the prophet for the completion of the desolation of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. So we know exactly why was Israel sent into exile to Babylon for 70 years. It was for 70 violations of the Sabbath year legislation. So what does that mean? If a Sabbath year is every 7 years, and Israel was exiled for 70 years for violating that law, how many years did Israel fail to practice the Sabbath year? Well, that would be 70 for the number of years in exile, right? Times 7, the Sabbath year. How many years is that, folks? 490 years. Now, this is kind of how we need to think about this. And you've got 490 years of disobedience to the Sabbath law, for which 70 years of exile are given. Okay, each Sabbath year is going to be spent in exile. 70 Sabbath years equates to 490 years of violating this law that comes up every seventh year. And so Daniel's prophecy then looks forward another 490 years for the completion of the thing. And now you'll note in the slide I have C. Samuel Sandmill, the New English Bible Textual Notes, and I give you the page there, 959. Here's why I put that in here. I want us to be very clear from the outset. We are not talking about some weird Christian spin on the Old Testament. Samuel Sandmill was the editor of the Old Testament in the New English Bible. He was also the director of biblical studies at Hebrew Union University. He is a Jewish man. He has nothing to say about Christ. But just for the sake of our understanding of the framework of this prophecy, I cite his work because it is universally held. What we've described so far, no one has objection to. Everyone agrees that this is exactly the framework to understand this period of time for the prophecy to have its completion, its fulfillment. Now let's take a look at the next verse, verse 25. He says, now listen and understand. He says, seven sevens plus 62 sevens will pass from the time the command is given to rebuild Jerusalem until a ruler, the anointed one, comes. And Jerusalem will be rebuilt with streets and strong defenses despite the perilous times. So who is this about then? It's about the anointed one. That's, of course, anointed In the Hebrew, that's where we get the word Messiah. That's where that comes from. And so he's talking about the time of the Messiah's coming. And what does it say? It says the Messiah will come after seven sevens plus 62 sevens. So that would be after 483 years. It's seven Sabbath years. That's 49. Okay, seven units of seven. Plus 62 units of seven equals 483 years. From the issuing of a decree, he says, to rebuild the city of Jerusalem until this ruler, 483 years. And then he gives some specific detail. He says that the command will include rebuilding the streets and the strong defenses of the city, despite maybe the difficulty in doing that. Are you with me? Do you follow? Okay, we're just inching our way forward. We got the time frame, 483 years. How do we calculate this? Well, from the issuing of a decree to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, including its defensive walls, until the Messiah comes. That's what we have. So now we need to ask ourselves, where does the countdown begin? Where does the beginning of this prophecy take root? And we have some options to consider here briefly. The first is a command given by Cyrus in 539 BC, very shortly after Cyrus, who was a Persian, destroyed the Babylonian Empire and took it over for himself. He issued an edict to rebuild the temple of God in Jerusalem. He was so blown away that the Jewish scriptures actually spoke of him, as we talked about last week. Right out of the book of Isaiah, he's like, wow, let's build a house for that God. So an edict was given. And I don't, at that point, certainly the temple was not rebuilt, but at least permission was given for it to happen. Darius in 519, as recorded in Ezra chapter 6, reissues Cyrus's decree because it had, after 20 years, not taken effect. Then in 457 BC, Artaxerxes issues permission for a migration back to Jerusalem. And it's a public kind of edict. It's like you hear safe passage to these Jewish people going back and repopulating the city of Jerusalem. But the one that is of particular importance to us is the decree of the same Artaxerxes later in 444 BC, recorded in Nehemiah 2. We'll take a look at this because this is a specific decree to authorize rebuilding the city. And so it therefore meets this specification that we have, that it's from the issuing forth of a decree to rebuild the city of Jerusalem until Messiah comes, as these 483 years. So let's take a look at this in Nehemiah 2. It says, in the month of Nisan, that's in the spring, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. And so Daniel is just giving us very specific, historically confirmable information. If you consult, well, you can do a Google search or Wikipedia thing. I guess no one reads encyclopedias anymore. Boy, I heard that the Encyclopedia Britannica is going out of print. They've been doing this since the 18th century, and they're done. It's a sign of the times. So you can't consult the newest copy of Encyclopedia Britannica. You got to go online. But you can find reliable sources that will tell you exactly the reign of Artaxerxes the king, which was started in 464 BC. It's an absolutely undisputable date. And so Nehemiah is describing a conversation that occurs in the spring of the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign, which would be what? That would be 444 BC. And so it says, I said to the king, if it please the king and if your servant has found your favor, send me to Judah, the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Okay, so he wants to rebuild what? The city of my father's tombs, which is, that's Jerusalem. That's what he's talking about there. And so it says, Artaxerxes responds positively. He says, let letters be given for the governors of the provinces beyond the river. and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, by timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress and the walls of the city. And the king granted this to me, he said. So that is the specific information that we need. Namely, it's a decree to go ahead and to rebuild the defensive structure of the city of Jerusalem. That's exactly what's required of Daniel's prophecy, that from the issuing forth of the decree to rebuild the city itself will be these 483 years. Now we have documentary evidence from Nehemiah of exactly when that proclamation was issued, the month of Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. Now let's bring together what we've been studying. If in 444 BC Artaxerxes' decree is given, then it will be possible for us to move forward 483 years. That's the seven sevens plus 62 sevens to the coming Messiah. Okay? Following me? Now, let's think about this for just one moment. You can kind of see just by the numbers where this is going. 44 BC plus 483 years. But let's be more specific, shall we? Don't you like specificity? I like specificity, especially when it comes to matters of God and what He's revealed to us. When these years are predicted, they are predicted in the frame of the ancient world's lunar calendar, which is a 360-year calendar. Modern timelines and modern dates given by historians are based not upon the lunar year, because we know that's inaccurate, but rather the solar year, because that is accurate. And so historians use as their system for assigning historical dates the whole solar calendar thing, unless I put in caveat here, you're in Ethiopia, where we were fairly recently, only to discover that it was 2004. Is that right? It was 2004. Yeah, Lou says that's right. I remember that correctly. They have not entered into the modern age of dating. And so therefore, I'm thinking, hey, it's 2012. And they're like, 2012? No, man, you're from the future. It's 2004. I'm like, oh, okay. But you see the problem here. You see that incongruity if you're working on a dating system based upon a lunar calendar instead of a solar calendar. So what we want to do is take Daniel's prophecy that was issued in lunar years and translate that to the kind of dating system that we use today if we want to get a specific date in mind. And how would we do that? Well, we would just simply take the 483 years that are in this prophecy, and we multiply that out times 360 days for each of those years, right? And so that gives us, in case you've got your calculator going, 173,880 days. That's how many actual days are a part of this prophecy that Daniel receives. And then we take those days, that 173,880 days, let's divide that now by the number of days in a solar year as opposed to a lunar year, and we get 476 solar years, real years, datable years. So that we can take that 476 years that modern historians would use to calculate an historic timeline beginning with 444 BC, and where does that take us? That takes us to 32 AD. That's interesting to me, as it may be to some of you. And yet we can still be more precise still, because while on a number line, minus 444 plus 476 gets you plus 32, years don't operate in the same way as a number line. In other words, what is the number between minus 1 and plus 1? It's 2, right? Because you got to go minus 1 to 0, 0 to 1, 2. But when you're measuring dates, there's no such thing as a 0 year. So 1 year is 1 BC and the next year is 1 AD. That's how that works. And so as a result, we add a number, another year to our calculation, because we've calculated in the 0 and we shouldn't, so we'll just put it on the end instead. That brings us to spring 33 AD, which most certainly is the best date for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And again, there's just not a whole lot of dispute about that. It's very interesting. It says, and we just want to read on, because we need to bring this thing to a conclusion and we need to do some analysis. In verse 26, it says, after the period of 62 sevens, the seven sevens and the 62 sevens, the anointed one, okay, the Messiah, will be killed. Will be killed, appearing to have accomplished nothing. Here's yet another prediction that Messiah, the anointed one, will come and he will die. And then it says, and a ruler will arise whose armies will destroy the city and the temple. And the end will come with a flood, and war and its miseries are decreed from that time to the very end. So then after the Messiah is killed, a ruler arises whose army will come, and then they will destroy Jerusalem and they will destroy the temple. Well, let's just morph a little bit ahead to the Gospel of Luke chapter 19. Because we'll see that this very prophecy is being fulfilled in the words of Christ and the work of Christ. When Jesus approached the city of Jerusalem, this is on Palm Sunday. This is the last week of Christ's life. When he approached the city, he saw the city and he wept over it, saying, if you had known in this day the things which make for peace, the days will come on you when your enemies will surround you and hem you in on every side, and they will level you to the ground and your children within you. They will not leave one stone upon another because, he says, you did not recognize the time of your visitation. And so Jesus is predicting about his own life exactly what Daniel describes. 33 AD, Messiah comes, is killed, and then their city was destroyed and their temple as well. Well, of course, that exactly happens. In 70 AD, Titus of Rome, the Roman general, comes and levels the city of Jerusalem and destroys the temple, just as Jesus has predicted. This is quite amazing, my friends. This is a remarkable prediction fulfillment that we see with all of its clarity and with all of its very fine-tuned specificity. And I want us to understand again that this is not just kind of a smoke and mirrors Christian take on this ancient Jewish text. There are ancient Jewish interpreters that exactly saw this the same way, citing the Jewish man who was an historian for Rome, namely Josephus. Josephus says a couple of things that bear very much on our understanding of this. He says in his Antiquities, He was hired by the Roman government to write histories of the Jewish people. And he says in Antiquities 10, I just read this week. He says, we believe that Daniel conversed with God, for he did not only prophesy of future events as did other prophets, but he also determined the time of their accomplishment. See, Daniel is seeing in the Josephus is seeing in the pages of Daniel 9 just exactly what we are describing, and he is speaking on behalf of official Judaism in doing so. He's saying this is how we view the prophet Daniel, our scholars, our scribes, our people. And further, he says in a book called The Jewish Wars, which was an account of the Jewish history with Rome and also with the Greeks before them. And it's a complicated story, but in the context of it, Josephus says this. He says about the rebellion of the Jewish people against the Romans that led up to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. It says their chief inducement, in other words, the main reason to go to war, was an oracle also found in their sacred writings announcing that at that time, a man from their country would become a ruler of the world. Clearly, what Josephus is describing here is consistent with the citation that I just put up before it, that they were understanding the prophecy of Daniel 9 to be complete in their lifetime, in their time. They didn't have the specific historiographical information we had. They couldn't date Artaxerxes at 444 BC. You know, it was in this year of that king, and so it was comparative stuff. And so they have approximations, they weren't exact. But they knew in a ballpark way, in a very close way indeed, that this is exactly the time when this prophecy was to be fulfilled. And I belabor this point to you because it's so important for us to realize that ancient interpreters in looking at this text, and in Jewish interpreters today indeed, often will see it in exactly these terms that are being described right here. It's not some kind of a Christian spin on the thing. And so we have, under close study, as we're beginning to sort of scratch the surface of this stuff, not just some generalized, ambiguous, Chinese fortune cookie prophecy, but we have very specific prediction made about who, what, why, where, when, and how God's Messiah would come into the world. And this exactly connects with Jesus. If not him, then who? If not him, then who? Because we've got the time. We've got what he does. We've got the whole thing nailed down here. So let's think about this just a little bit. Here is some evidence for us to consider. And as we have been considering over these last few weeks, Jesus asks this question repeatedly in Mark 8, also in John chapter 6. We'll talk about this in a couple of weeks. Jesus asks this question. He says, "Who do you say that I am?" See, that's a really super important question. He's not asking in a kind of a general philosophical sense, you know, who do people think I am? He does ask that question, but he asks his disciples this question. He says, "Who do you say that I am?" And so what he's doing is he is calling them to assess the evidence, to render a verdict, to stand your ground. Where are you at on these things? And I just want to close with a couple of thoughts. First, about what is authentic seeking? And I think, you know, I'm totally aware that there are quite a number of us here tonight, as has been the case over these last few weeks, we're here out of curiosity, who are here because we've been given some reason to believe that there might be something true in the Christian message, a friend perhaps who's made their faith surprisingly real to us enough that we'd want to explore a little bit more. And we wonder, what does it mean to be an authentic seeker of God, a seeker of truth? What it really is about is an open-minded exploration of the evidence, of doing the work of saying, okay, here is the text. Here is Isaiah chapters 52 and 53. Read it. What does it say? What possible conclusions can you reach about who this person is and what is it that they are accomplishing? How would you read Daniel chapter 9 and understand this prediction of the coming of God's Messiah, who after this period of time will die, and then the city of Jerusalem and its temple will be destroyed? How do you piece that together? And in an open-minded way, not in the way that says, I'm just kind of a cynic that is going to look at this stuff and well, I got my explanation. I know what it is. Aliens from Mars, or whatever. Maybe the reality is that that we are all just a dream in the mind of God, and tomorrow He wakes up and we cease to exist. You know, is that possible? Well, yeah, it is possible. Is that likely? Don't think so. You know, being open-minded means really going to the evidence and saying, where does the evidence take me? What is it saying? What are the alternatives? The plausibility of Christ's claims, rooted in the very plausible notion that there really does exist a God. That's very plausible indeed when we think about the complexity and the finite nature of our universe, the now universal concession that the universe had a beginning and a moment in time, which begs this question, what God it started. We look at the complexity of life and we wonder, how is this possible in a system that is blind to reason and meaning? We look within ourselves and we realize that there is dignity in ourselves and in all human beings, dignity that cannot arise from just being more sophisticated fungus than a mushroom or something like that. That there's something uniquely different about humankind. Something that, as Genesis says, is speaks of the image of God. Now, those aren't proofs for God, but what we're saying is that belief in God is plausible. Belief in a personal God is plausible given the evidence. And so what Jesus is doing is he's pushing that analysis just one step further to say that intelligent personal God who is the creator of all things, including you, has manifested himself uniquely in the person of Jesus Christ to demonstrate his great love for you by fulfilling the predictions that he laid down in his word hundreds of years before. That's very plausible. And so there is this need then to weigh the evidence, the historical evidence for these texts, to assess the eyewitness evidence contained within these texts and their claims. And to realize we're not talking about primitive people who are just putting together comforting stories or something like that. Peter puts it like this. He says in 2 Peter 1, he says, we did not follow cleverly devised tales. Literally in the Greek, tales is mythos, myth. We didn't follow myths when we told you of the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. He says, but we were eyewitnesses. We were eyewitnesses. And so an authentic seeker is one who, with an open mind, takes the text in its own terms, evaluates it, assesses it, considers alternatives. It's a part of the seeking. But at a certain time, we have to understand that there is everything at stake here. Absolutely everything's at stake here. Okay? Because if Jesus Christ is right in his claims, he makes a claim on your life. Okay? If Jesus Christ is right, if the evidence for him is compelling, then he is coming to us here tonight and he is making a claim on us. And he's saying, you're lost. You're alienated from me. As I've told you hundreds of years before, there's nothing you can do to make yourself acceptable, to make yourself right before me. I've declared that, and it's not an option. Religion is not an option. The only way that we can find ourselves reconciled to the one true God, to a holy God, a personal God, is by entrusting our guilt on the only provision that he made for that guilt, which is his son, which is the Messiah. Okay, so that's what's at stake here. You say to yourself, well, I'll get around to that someday. You say to yourself, well, that's kind of interesting. I didn't know that about Christianity. Or whatever. And what I'm suggesting here is that every day, in a concrete and practical way, you are betting your life on something. You're betting your life on something. If you don't make a decision to respond to the offer of forgiveness in Christ, then you are betting your life on your own basic goodness and acceptability to God. You're betting your life on that. If you're not prepared to entrust your life to Christ, you're betting your life that you know a better way than he does for how to live and what life is really all about. You're betting your life on that. So there is no place for disinterested, just intellectualism in this area. This is an intensely personal, consequential issue that we are putting on the table, that Christ puts on the table for us here. You are literally betting your life that something is true. What is it? And do you have good reason to accept what you're betting your life on is really true? Because at the end of the day, when you wipe away all of the distractions that in our culture that keep us from really looking at this thing in the quiet of your own heart, that is the issue that's on the table. What are you betting your life on? And then lastly, just want to say a couple things here. Two kinds of knowing. We've talked about one kind of knowing, factual knowing, based on reasonable inference from available data. We've been trying to argue here that the preponderance of evidence strongly supports the claims of Jesus Christ as God's unique Son, God incarnate, and that he is indeed Messiah risen from the dead. We think that there are very strong and convincing reasons for that, rooted in the Old Testament, rooted in our analysis of the historical documents of the New Testament and the eyewitness testimony contained within them, and other things as well. We think that's a pretty convincing case for the preponderance of evidence being on the side of that yes, these things are true. And certainly true in relation to the alternatives, which don't seem to really be coming out at all. What's the alternative explanation for these things? But importantly and finally, there's a personal knowing that God is intensely interested in as well. A personal knowing that is beyond factual knowledge. Factual knowledge is very, very important. We need to know true things. Because in knowing true things, that gives us a window into the possibility of knowing truly a person. But all of the factual information in the world will never give you personal knowledge. I can read every encyclopedia there is about Isaac Newton and read all of his biographies, and I can know, at least in theory, I suppose, what he did every day of his life, what he thought about, what he valued. It'd be kind of a pathetic waste of life to have that kind of a study, but it could be done. But even if I could have exhaustive factual information about Isaac Newton, in meeting him, he would say to me, "I never knew you. We didn't have a relationship. You knew about me, but you didn't know me." And see, here's the thing. If Jesus did, in fact, as he said, rise from the dead, then he is alive and he can be known. And indeed, he is calling out to us, even here tonight. And he is saying in the words of Revelation 3, verse 20, "Behold, I stand at the door of your life, of your heart, knocking, knocking." And anyone who opens that door, I will come into them and I'll dine with them, and they with me, and others will have this relationship, this connection with one another. And this then is sort of this last step in the thing. That ultimately what we're talking about here is a relationship, a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And one of the things I think that if we're going to be seekers with integrity is that we also want to take up that seeking with God Himself. And we would ask, okay, God, I'm not entirely sure that you're there or that these things are true, but I do want to know you. If you're there, I want to know you. And so as I assess this information, as I think this through, I'm just asking, will you, in because you say you're personal, in some personal way, communicate yourself to me? Will you reveal yourself to me in a way that I get it, that I can understand? Yes, you are for real. And there are hundreds of people in this auditorium tonight who have interacted with God in just this way. And we have hundreds of very different stories about how God, in His distinctly personal way, has come to us as individuals and given us that sense of assurance within our own heart that the things that we are discovering, the things that seem to make sense, are in fact true. And a seeker is one who seeks out the person. And maybe then too we're at that place where we've done that. We believe that we have met the living God through Jesus Christ. And now I think this is the stuff that our faith really needs to rest in here is to zealously pursue God because we have a reasoned basis to move towards Him. Everyone has spent betting their life on something. The incredibly insane thing about so many Christians is that while they have personal faith in Jesus Christ, they're betting their life on something completely different. They're betting their life on their reputation, their good looks, their accumulated wealth, whatever it is. But see, if what we're talking about is true, if this is really true, who gives a what you earn, how you look, what people think of you? What really matters is, Lord, what is your call on my life? How can I live for you? And that's really the value, I think, of these exercises. That's why they're in the Bible. They're stimuli for us to really get our heads straight and think about what's important, what really matters.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.